Thank you. Hi, my name is Joe. I am an alcoholic. And thank everyone for being here, because without you, there is no meeting. And I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as it was shown to me. And I was told that, you know, I got to give it away to keep it. And that means working with another alcoholic and doing service and talking about who I am and my experience. My first AA meeting was December 15th, 2001. My sobriety date is July 1st, 2018. And I believe my journey and my message can help those who have experienced the same things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I experienced. I have two different Alcoholics Anonymous stories, but I'm the same person. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sharing with Rich that I just wanted to fix myself. I had tried with, you know, the Power of Positive Thinking books and church and, you know, other self-help. At the time, it was called self-help, you know, literature and people. But I did all of that while I was drinking a bottle of vodka. Right? So many of you may know the town, or familiar with the town that I was living in, and it's called Delusionville. You know, and I didn't realize how delusional I was. I went to my first meeting, and I was like, wow, this is great. Like, you know, I can share, you know. It was almost like I realized that I was in this free therapy, right? Because it was people, they were talking about themselves, and they were talking about why they drank, and they were talking, and they were laughing, and they were talking, and there were some serious comments made, you know, of their stories, and they were talking about sobriety. I didn't really understand anything they were saying. They said I had to get a sponsor, and you know, I do a 90 in 90 days, and I was like, okay, did whatever I was told to do, because I felt like I belonged with these people. Also because I felt my ego told me that I was going to be the poster child for AA. Right? I was going to be Mr. AA, and I'm going to show these people how great I am. Right? I came in, I was married, I had a house. Actually, I was living in an apartment, and you know, I was making money. I was running, you know, I had a little carpentry business that I was doing. I was feeling really good about myself, but I couldn't stop drinking. And my wife had told me, you know, something's wrong with you. You need to go get some help. I knew what it was. I knew that, you know, I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know what that meant. I just thought that meant that I drank too much, right? I just drank too much, and I would pass out and black out. And I went to my first AA meeting to satisfy her and to actually, you know, gave me permission to be alcoholic, right? Gave me permission to say I'm going to go help myself, and I'm going to go to a meeting, and I'm an alcoholic, I'm doing something about it. And I came home and I told her, and she was like, oh, you know, what do you mean you went to an AA meeting? I says, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I think, and, you know, I drink a lot. I'm like, I don't know if you've noticed. She's like, well, you know, I just thought you work hard and it's okay for you to drink. And when she used to tell me that, it gave me permission to continue to drink more. And she started crying. She was like a little upset. And I'm like, you know, why are you upset? And she's like, I'm not upset. I'm kind of happy because, you know, I thought I married a nut job. You know, I thought I married something crazy. So at least this, you know, this is something you could fix, maybe, you know, get some help for. She was, you know, very, very encouraging. Anyway, I spent, you know, a lot of time in my first run in AA. I spent almost 10 years. It was very close to 10 years. It was around November that I went out, and 2009, 2010, or something like that. But I did a lot. You know, I went to a lot of meetings. I did over 90 meetings in 90 days. I did close to 100 meetings, or 100-something meetings in 90 days. I made a lot of friends. I went to a lot of picnics, did a lot of sober stuff, went on sober dances, and, you know, showed off my wife, and you know, I played this role of, you know, that AA poster child. I thought that's what I needed to do in order to feel good about myself. But I always remember, I always know, like, I was going to sleep every night, most nights, with this quiet desperation, not feeling any better, but just not drinking, right? And when I woke up in the morning, I would go to work and go to routine and put on, it was almost like I was putting on this persona, like this physical persona of somebody that I wanted everybody to think I was in sobriety. I regurgitated information out of the big book. I never read the big book. If you wanted to hide something, all you had to do was put it in here, right? But I did hear people that knew the big book and talked about it, and I would regurgitate page 24 about the real alcoholic and, you know, how it works. I could say that I committed that to memory, and after about a year or so, I started sponsoring people, and I had a sponsor, a very well-meaning man, right? And he took me on hikes, and he introduced me to some self-empowering groups, you know, nothing to do with AA, and I really liked him. He was a really good guy, and I realized that he couldn't help me, because I always felt I was living in that quiet desperation. I always felt like I was somewhere else when I wasn't living in the world, operating in society. So I got another sponsor, and he was a little more, you know, programmed, but he was a Catholic, and you know, we went to church, and we really didn't do any work in the big book, and, you know, they took me through the third step and the fourth step, and they did the best they could. They were very well-meaning people, and, you know, I met a lot of good people in AA, but they couldn't help me, you know. And it was a time in my life around 2008, 2007, you know, I had leveraged myself and working on, you know, homes and flipping them. I leveraged myself, and things started to go bad financially in the country and for me. And, you know, I didn't realize how attached I was to those things, because I had done a lot of work outside of AA with Eckhart Tolle or Deepak Chopra, all these gurus, you know, the top names, and looking for this spirituality and actually wearing it. It wasn't in me, it was on me. You know, I believed it because I knew it was true. I didn't know why it was true, but I couldn't live it. I couldn't digest it. And I would regurgitate that, and I would sound really good. People thought I had it going on. You know, they believed me, but I knew I was a fraud. I would look at pictures of myself and my wife and my family, and me in those pictures, and like, I would look at myself. I couldn't even look at myself in those pictures because I knew that guy was a fraud. But I didn't know how not to be that way. I thought, this is what I got to do. You know, maybe I got to live in this quiet desperation for the rest of my life. And when things started to go bad, all those things that I thought was me, like the material things, the outside things, I thought that that's what made me who I was, my job, my life situation. When that started to go, guess who went with it? I did. You know, I was a shell. I got depressed. Went to see doctors. They gave me medication, Lexapro, and all these antidepressants, and, you know, they weren't really working. They made me a little fuzzy and stuff like that. I was going to church. I was the president of the board. I was well-liked in my community. Still living in this quiet desperation. I didn't know why. And I didn't have a solution. But I knew, I didn't have a solution for that, but I knew what my solution could be. I mean, I knew what my solution was in the past. My solution was alcohol. And that's exactly what I went back to. I took that first, I bought a little pint of Absolut vodka, and I started drinking it, and the first thing I thought was, like, it wasn't like, wow, I just threw away 10 years, or, you know, what are people going to say? The first thing I thought was, like, what was I thinking not drinking for 10 years? What was I thinking about? Like, I'm back. You know? This is me. I'm back. That's what it did to me, and that's what it did to me all my life. I didn't like drinking. I loved the way it made me feel. 100%. And when I felt like I was back, like, that pint was just so good. And then I could go, you know, I went a week without, you know, having another drink. And I bought another pint on the weekend. I was drinking on the weekends. And I took this job on the road because things had gone so bad. I stopped sleeping with my wife. I had put a little room in the basement. I stopped sleeping with my wife. And she found somebody else to sleep with. Right? So now I had permission to feel sorry for myself and to blame someone for what I'm going through. And I opened a door that I couldn't close for 6 years. Up until that point, I never had a DUI or any kind of run-ins with the law from alcohol. Within 6 months, I had 2 DUIs in 2 different states. One in Illinois and one in Elko, Nevada. And the one I got in Elko, Nevada, the job fired me. And I had to take a bus home from Elko, Nevada. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm like on the other side of the country. You want me to go back to Jersey on a bus? It's going to take like 3 days. And they're like, yeah, well, that's how we roll. You know? And they got me a bus ticket. And I went to the liquor store, and I drank, and I lost the bus ticket. And I had to buy another bus ticket. And I got on the bus, and I'm like, and I got off the bus in Utah. And I'm like, I can't do this. I can't stay on this bus for 3 days. So I had some money. They had paid me. I had some money. I was like, I'm going to get a hotel room, get a plane, and come back to Jersey. And that's what I did. And when I came back to Jersey, I was working on my 3rd DUI. It didn't stop me. And I was like, I'm going to lose my license. The only thing that I have now, I've lost everything else, and I'm going to lose my driver's license. I knew I had to be accountable for this. I couldn't, like, dodge these states because I figured in my mind that it would come back. Everything's on a computer. I'm going to lose my license in New Jersey. But I didn't care. I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop drinking. I tried, you know. And I started going back to meetings. And I had put together, like, 18 months. And in those 18 months, I got married and had a kid. That was my solution. That was another solution. And I started drinking again when the marriage wasn't working out. Obviously, I was still in Delusionville, right? All this time, I didn't realize how delusional I was, making stuff up. When the marriage didn't work out, again, that gave me permission to drink. Everything gave me permission to drink. If I lost my keys, it was a reason to drink. If I found my keys, it was a reason to drink. And everything in my life gave me permission to drink. And I spent almost 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous as an untreated alcoholic. And the result was that door that opened and turned my life into, as Bill says, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Penniless, homeless, living in a homeless shelter, living in my car, broke, no friends. That's where it took me. And I had to get on welfare because I needed money. And they were giving me food stamps. But the requirement was that I go to these IOPs, right? These intensive outpatient programs. and I would have to, you know, give them a urine so that they would say that, you know, that I'm not drinking, because the requirement for me to continue my benefits was to stay clean. But I couldn't do that. And they were like, well, we're going to kick you out of the program, or you're going to go to rehab, and you're going to, if you don't go to rehab, you're going to lose everything. And I really didn't want to go to rehab, because I thought that I could do this on my own. I thought that I can get better. You know, that was enough for me to say, okay, let me do this on my own. I got a job, small job, like, you know, self-employed job, hanging doors or renovating a bathroom. But I couldn't finish those jobs. I was, you know, I was really trying hard to do the right thing, but I couldn't stop drinking, because drinking gave me energy, right? It made me smarter, made me feel better about myself, made me feel better about my current position and my life situation and what I had done. So I started drinking again while I was in the IOP, living in the homeless shelter. I got kicked out of the shelter. I went to Turning Point for 31 days. I left my car in a Walgreens parking lot, a little 1989 Nissan Sentra that I was living in, and that was any place to live. It was that or the homeless shelter. And when I got there, all I wanted to do was leave. I'm like, how long do I have to be here? They're like, it's a 30-day program. I'm like, okay. I heard people can leave in 15 days. I said, well, if the counselor thinks you can leave in 15 days. So that was my goal, to leave in 15 days. I was telling my counselor that. He's like, what do you got to do? Like, where are you going to go? Like, I was working. I got my car. I left it in a parking lot. He's like, you weren't taking care of anything before you got here. What makes you think you're going to take anything when you get out of here? He goes, just stay the 30 days and see what happens. And within this 30 days, they brought in speakers. And again, posing as the poster child for AA. They had only one big book. I was the only one reading it. They had, you know, notebooks. I was the only one writing, you know, and regurgitating that same information again, because I wasn't like everybody else in that place. You know, it was 72 men in there, and I wasn't like any of them. I was different. I was better. Oh, I was just different. And this guy came in to speak, H&I Commitments. He's in the Way Out group in Roselle. His name is Chuck, and he's not a farmer, but they call him Farmer Chuck because he ended up going to a farm for rehab, right? And he told this very entertaining, heartfelt, authentic story about his experience. And I was like, wow, you know, let me go talk to this guy. I didn't want to talk to anybody, but I was like, let me talk to this guy. I went up to him, and he looks at me, and I'm like, hey, I really love what you had to say. He goes, do I know you from somewhere? I'm like, I don't think so, but maybe, you know, maybe you see me in a meeting back in the days. Anyway, take this card, take my card, here's my number. He goes, promise me you do something when you get out of here. You go to your hand, you go to a meeting, and you raise your hand, and you ask for a sponsor that's had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, okay. And you call me when you get out. I'm like, okay. I didn't do any of that. I didn't call him, I didn't go to a meeting. 3 weeks later, I was drinking again, living in my car. And the cops knock on my window at 3 o'clock in the morning. I would have it running because it was a little chilly out. You know, they said, well, you can't stay in your car. You're drunk. Like, we can't let you stay here. Like, you got to leave. You got to go to a hospital. Or you're going to go to jail. Which one do you want to do? I'm like, all right, I'll go to the hospital. That was the first one. Again, same thing happened again. 3 days later. You want to go to the hospital? Or you want to go to jail? I'm like, I was in the hospital 3 days ago. Again, you know, I guess I'll go to the hospital. You know, I ended up with 3 hospital bands on my wrists. I couldn't stay in my car anymore, so I decided to drink on the street. They poked me with a stick on the street, fall asleep in front of McDonald's or something like that. I was a bum. I had achieved homelessness and that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that Bill Wilson talks about. So going back to what Chuck had told me. I was sitting in the car one day, and I couldn't really drive it, but if I had the opportunity to put gas in it or buy alcohol, I would buy alcohol. And I was stealing alcohol. You know, I was going into big alcohol shop rights and stuff like that and sticking it in my jacket. You know, I worked on making amends to that, but that's down the road. Anyway, I'm sitting in the car, and the hospital made the mistake of giving me a prescription for Librium, which was supposed to maintain the delirium tremors, right? But it's a hardcore, like, antidepressant, like, brings you down. But I wasn't getting sick. So I'm taking the Librium, and I'm drinking. And I'm just passing out wherever I sit down, right? And I'm in my car, and I'm like, this is it. Like, I'm going to die this way. I text my wife, forget about me. Don't ever call me again. You're never going to see me again. And this guy's out of nowhere, his words came. He says, like, there was no solution for me. And he said, you know, ask for a sponsor who's had a, you know, spiritual experience. And I called a stranger that was supposed to give me a job that I never showed up for. And I knew he was in AA. And I said, do you know anyone that's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? And I said that in, like, kind of like a sarcastic, unknowing that I was going to get, like, an answer that, you know, didn't really fit what I was asking, because I've never heard anybody ask that question before. And he says, yes, I do. And I was like, you do? He says, yeah, he'll call you back in 10 minutes. And he did. He called me back. He's my sponsor today. He said, where are you? Can you get to the Skyview Motel on 46? And I said, yes. It took me about 3 hours to get there, and he was there 2 hours before that. He was like, can you call me? Where are you? Where are you? And the reason I had a phone, right, because it seems kind of contradictory, like I'm penniless, I'm homeless, and I have a phone. But the reason I have a phone is because my first ex-wife wanted to make sure that I was okay and that her daughter's father wasn't dead somewhere. So she paid for my phone bill. That was the only reason I had the phone. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to contact anybody. And he met me there, and he said, sleep this off for 2 days, and I did. That was on June 28th of 2018. I slept it off. What I thought was a day was 2 days. You know, I had plans on taking a shower and everything, feeling a little better about myself. That didn't happen. I just crashed for 2 days. He came and picked me up, and he said, we're going to do some work, you know, in about a week or two. And I was like, good. Like, you know, I could use some work. I need some money, you know. He's like, no. That's not the work we're going to do. He says, you can meet me at my house in Fort Lee, you know, and we're gonna start doing some big work. He goes, use your phone and go read the first 8 pages of Bill's story. And when you're done with that, you know, I'll call you and we'll discuss that. And then when you meet me, we'll start going through the book. And we opened the book. He bought me the book, by the way. I says, oh, I have a big book. I got two of them. I never looked at them, right? But he said, I got a big book. And I had the little one they gave me in rehab, and the other one, I didn't know where it was, but I said I had it anyway. And he says, no, you're not going to use that book. I'm going to buy you one. And he bought me this book, right? I put the cover on it when I had nothing to do in my car. And we opened the book, and we wrote the date we started working, July 20th, 2018. And it says $9.50 on the book. And then he tells me a story about Alcoholics Anonymous and some about the book with some copyright infringement. Alcoholics Anonymous used the circle and the triangle, but someone had said that someone had copyrighted it. I'm not clear on it. I don't want to give you any misinformation. But anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous had to take the logo out of the book, the circle and the triangle. And he said they took it out. We put it back. And he gave me a quarter. I drew a circle around it. I drew a circle around the quarter. I drew the triangle. And he wrote, Unity, Service, Recovery, Mind, Body, Spirit, 12 Steps, 12 Traditions, 12 concepts. Alcoholics Anonymous is a three legacy meeting, and they made it that way to ensure its existence. And it works, because I'm sitting here today telling you the story. And this was the beginning of my journey with the big book. And I was sick. I immediately copped the resentment for Alcoholics Anonymous. I had sworn not to go back anymore, but I was like, what was going on for 10 years that I didn't even know this? How do I not know this? He's like, listen, there are many different types of AA meetings. Maybe you aren't going to the right ones. Right? Let's not get into that right now. Let's keep going with the book. And he told me what the unity side of it meant, what the service side of it meant, and what the recovery side of it meant. And we started going through the book from page zero, going through the preface. And I started underlining what he told me to underline and highlighting what he told me to highlight. And when he got to the preface, he started reading this to me. And I'm sitting there going, what is this guy doing? Like, you know, this is the fourth edition of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, kind of feeling weird about it. But it didn't matter what I was feeling. Because when I looked at him, it wasn't the man that was reading to me. It was the spirit of the man that was reading to me. That I could see. And I had no experience with that before. Because he didn't care what I was thinking or what I was feeling. He wasn't the same person that I spoke to on the phone, that picked me up. He became this book. And the pages and the words in this book started to come alive. Like, I get emotional about it because I remember exactly how I felt. And the words in this book started to come alive. And I started to learn who I was. I started to learn the history of AA. I started to realize that I lived under a dangerous misconception that I didn't have anything in common with my ancestors from 100 years ago. I couldn't possibly have anything in common with Bill and Bob in 1939. But that was dangerous for me because I am exactly like them. I'm capable of the same self-destructive behavior, the same vile power struggles, the same alcoholic tendencies, and the same crimes against humanity. Nothing has changed. I started to realize that. I better pay attention. Because they're talking about me. We went to the doctor's opinion. I was just reading this with John. And he's like, you know, we got to this part where it says, this is a story of thousands of men and women that have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I'm like, why don't they say alcohol? He's like, because the alcoholic suffers from a seemingly homeless, hopeless state of mind and body. And it's it's right here. If you want to take a look at it, on XXVI, the doctor's opinion, XXV. The doctor starts to write, to whom it may concern. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And I wrote, he wants to quit, but he can't. Now, on XXV1, which is 26, the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as the mind. And when you start to cross-reference this information, you start to realize why they wrote, we suffer from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Then that made sense to me. And so on and so on and so on. As we went through the book, we started to cross-reference all the information back on page in Bill's story, back to the beginning. In the solution, back to the beginning. you know, in each chapter, we went back and forth and back and forth, and it started to weave. It was this tapestry that was starting to come together in this picture that I started to see, which was truth. There was no lie in that. There was no opinion. There was no embellishment. And there was no concern for anybody's feelings. It was just unadulterated truth. And when I say these words started to come alive, I started to live this book. I started to feel it. It started to become part of me. And I just wanted more. And I would meet him every week to do more work in this book. And I would do exactly what he told me. We signed a little contract in the beginning. He said, "You're going to write this. Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And I'm like, "Yes, I am." I didn't know what that meant. But yeah, I'll do that. "Are you willing to see the work through?" I said, "Yes, I'll do that." And he said, "Are you willing to take directions from me?" And I said, "Yes, I'll do that." It was easy to say yes to those questions. And he says, "Okay, now we have a contract." Break the contract, you know. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not telling you how to do it. I'm telling you, you know, I'm not going to tell you anything. But you break the contract, it's on you. It's not on me. I'll always be here. The message has been the same since they wrote this book. It's not my message, he tells me. It's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I'm telling you today may be my experience with alcohol, but the message is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I take no credit for it. I'm only here to transmit it in an understanding that was given to me. So, we get to page 2, we go through Bill's story, right? And he tells me to underline everything that I can identify with. I underline 80% of his story. So finally, we get the stuff that I'm familiar with, right? Like how it works. "Rarely have we seen a person fail." Page 58. Everyone knows this. If you're new, or you're coming back, and this is new to you, this is important. "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program." And many of you have heard this before, and if you haven't heard this before, you've probably heard it in the beginning of the meetings. And I asked him the question, I'm like, "What step are we on now?" He's like, "We're still in step one." I'm like, "We're like 60 pages in." He's like, "No, we're still in step one. We're not even, you know, we're just maybe 2/3 done with step one." Right? And I'm sorry. We're in step two. I apologize. He says, "What step one?" He says, "Step two." I says, "Well, when did it go from step one to step two?" Right? And he says, "Well, when we started We Agnostics, we were in step two." I said, "So from page 1 to 43, from the beginning of this book to page 43, that was step one." He says, "Yeah, that's why it's the most important step." And I'm like, there's 164 pages. That's like almost a third of the 164 pages. He's like, "Yeah, that's right." And when I was done understanding how this book was laid out in steps, I had to accept that I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous and the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where the steps began and where they ended. And it would say it in here. And I didn't know that, you know, this 12 steps are in the 164 pages. And again, another resentment. How do I not know this? How does no one tell me this? After 10 years of being in the program. And he says, Joe, listen. You have to understand that this work is going to change you. And change is difficult. And for some reason, or for some, you know, purpose, God has given you your experience. And that's for you to embrace and to own. And I still wasn't buying it, right? Because I'm like, what kind of program is this? Like, I can go to meetings and know nothing about the big book, just the 12 steps, the 12 and 12. Like, what's going on here? You know, I wanted some answers. And he says, it's got nothing to do with anybody else. He says, it's all about to do with you. You decide your own level of involvement. This book wasn't hiding anywhere. It wasn't going anywhere. There were people out there that had spiritual awakenings as a result of these steps. You danced around all of that. I had to own the fact that I was the one that didn't want to get into this book. I was the one that didn't want to live the steps. I was the one that didn't want the information because I wanted to figure it out on my own. I wanted the easier, softer way. And it wasn't sustainable. And I remained an untreated alcoholic for 10 years. And now I can recognize. You know what I say? It takes one to know one. I can recognize an untreated alcoholic when I see them. And I don't approach anyone with any derogatory comments or degrading behavior, you know, or insults, or I don't shame anyone for being where they are. I simply say, listen, you know, if you want to go through the book with me, I'll take you through the book. Or I know someone that can. Sometimes they say no and sometimes they don't. But that's the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the truth that I had to accept about myself. And what I didn't know and what I wasn't willing to learn. And after we got done with the first step, I had an experience of knowing what made me tick. But that still wasn't enough, right? I knew why I was an alcoholic. I knew why I drank the way I drank. And I knew why I lived the way I live. And the problem was in my mind. I had to change my mind. I had to change the way I was thinking about everything and anything that I knew, especially when it came to this disease. And we got to step two, and he's like, we agnostics, and he's like, I had no problem believing God because that's all I was searching for, you know. I was searching for something that can give me an answer to my purpose in life. And we read this part. Let's see what page is it. The agnostics. We can only clear the ground a bit. This is on page 55. It's the 1, 2, 3, third chapter down. It's the last chapter. It's the second chapter before the last. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourage you to search diligently within yourself, then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway.
With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. And I was like, this is a promise. He's like, yeah. The consciousness of your belief will come to you. You cannot fail. Like, this is a second step promise that we don't really hear about. And we moved on to page 56. And it just kept coming like this for me. And I just kept, wow, like, just being blown away by it. Who are you to say there is no God? This man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years had swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. And that's exactly how I felt. I realized that whatever puts the leaves on the trees in the fall and takes them off in the puts the leaves on the trees in the spring and takes them off in the fall, it's not me. Whatever keeps this blue rock from spinning out of its orbit, it's not me. Whatever keeps my heart beating, my lungs working, my functions, my digestive system, it's not me. You know, there's a divine intelligence, aka Creator, aka God. Whatever label you want to put on it, it's not me. And I had to realize that I had to stop running the show. And I submitted to this power. And I submitted to this intelligence. In a totally different understanding. It wasn't the preacher man's understanding. Because I was looking for that God, right? The preacher man had a God. So I had to think that his God was the right God. The guru, the self-help guru had a God, right? I wanted his God. Everybody else had a God that they could explain and identify with, and I wanted that, right? I wanted to see what that looked like, because maybe that would work for me. Because I didn't have enough courage in myself, I didn't have enough self-esteem, I didn't have enough understanding about who I was to know that step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, had value. Because I didn't have anything tangible that I could see, touch, and feel. And it was explained to me that you need to have your own understanding of God, a personal and intimate personal relationship with your Creator, divine intelligence, aka God. And I started to realize that if this power and this Creator has all these children, how could it possibly support that? And I thought about my mother, and she has four kids. She's passed away now. And I thought about my sister and my brothers, and she loved all of us, right? But she had an intimate, a different relationship with each and every one of us. My mother knew me. My mother couldn't talk to me like she talked to my brother or my sister. My mother couldn't raise me like she raised my sister. She was a girl. And I realized that she all had the same love for us. And I realize that this divine intelligence has the same love. It's possible to love that, all of that, everyone on this planet. But that intimate relationship between me and my mother, my brother couldn't have it. My sister couldn't have it. My father couldn't have it. Her sister couldn't have it. Her aunt, whatever, so on. Whatever family member she had in her life that loved her and she loved, they couldn't have the same relationship she had with me. And this is where I started to understand that this is where I started to develop my intimate and personal relationship with the God of my understanding. That everything that I am and everything that I know and everything that I don't know and everything that I did and everything that I became didn't disqualify me from having this relationship. It didn't disqualify me from being a better man. It didn't disqualify me from changing. It didn't disqualify me from anything that I thought it would, especially humanity. And this relationship that I had, I submitted to. I did whatever was in front of me. I put my life in God's hands. The things that I have to do every day are very important. These little things. And I realized how important the little things are. I have to wake up. I have to put my socks on and put my shoes on and brush my teeth and get dressed and go to and start my car, put gas in my car. Like, all these things I have to do are important. But after that, I don't know how my day is going to go. I can't write that down. I just got to do what's in front of me. Because my relationship with my higher power has put that there for me to do. It's mine to do. If it wasn't, it would be in somebody else's hands. But I walked away from that my entire life. I walked away from doing what was mine to do because I thought I should be doing something else. I thought life was about being on vacation. I wanted to be rich and famous without doing the work. I thought life was about being on the beach, hanging out, and drinking margaritas or whatever your drink is. That's a little bit of life. That's like this much of life. Life is about the things we have to do every day, and I didn't realize how successful I was in that because I took it for granted, and I didn't realize that was what my Creator was putting in front of me every day to do. The things that I didn't know I had to do. And when I started doing those things with no question, my life started to change without my permission. And it wasn't easy. When I got out of rehab, when I got out of living in my car in December, I moved into a room. It was the size of a closet. I basically lived with like certifiably crazy people in that same house. It was a rooming house. I had bed bugs. I had alcoholics living next door, but I had a place to live. I dealt with it. And I would call my sponsor every day. He was like, "This is part of your journey, man." I'm like, "This can't be okay." He's like, "You'll get through it, man. You'll get through it." Any help that he would have offered me outside of that would have taken away from my journey. Would have taken away from where I'm at now. You know, this, and I thought this, all of this was about cash and prizes. I'm going to get sober and I'm going to get the cash and prizes back. No, the real cash and prizes is about knowing who I am. There's nothing more valuable than knowing who I am and knowing what I need to submit to and becoming a productive member of society. And what that means to me today, and I was reading this to John, I wrote it down and I read it every day because I don't remember it. My goal is to be a productive member of society. That does not mean that I conform to the patterns of popular culture, politics, or religion. It means that I must be so emotionally organized that my existence will increase the productivity of everyone and everything that surrounds me. I wrote that as a goal, and I live that today. I don't even know what that looks like. Like, I don't even know when I read that. I don't even know who wrote it, but I know it's my handwriting, so I did it. And I go out every day because of this second step. I go out every day and put my life in God's hands. And things seem to work out without my permission. You know, and I want to encourage everyone, you know, to continue your search. And never apologize for believing what you believe. Because it says that in the We Agnostics. We never apologize for God. It says that in this book. And that also gave me the courage and the backbone to build my personal relationship with a power greater than myself. That's all I got for tonight. Thank you.